The book of Daniel is a book that probably most of you are really familiar with, or at least really familiar with certain portions of the book. There are some of the stories in Daniel that a lot of people have been taught from the time of their youth in Bible classes. There may be some parts of the book that you're not as familiar with, but we're going to be focusing mainly on some chapters that if you have been a Christian for very long or been in Bible classes for very long, you're probably pretty familiar with. We just finished up looking at Ezekiel, and one of the points that I made when we were looking at Ezekiel was about the captivities or the captivity of Judah by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and how that came in three different deportations from the land. And the first one happened in 605 or 606 B.C. The second one happened in 597. And then the final one, when the destruction of Jerusalem came about, was 586 B.C. Ezekiel was in the second deportation. But what about Daniel as well as his three friends? Do you know when or which of those three they would have been included in? Yeah, they were in the first one. Okay, and we typically know his three friends as Shadrach, Meshach, and not Abednego, but Abednego. I don't know if you were like me, you grew up saying Abednego, but it's Abednego. But those are their Babylonian names. Can anybody, without cheating, tell me their Jewish names? It's given in chapter 1. You can go ahead and look if you have to. But it's really the only time that it's mentioned. Yeah, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Those are the their names, their Jewish names, but then they were given Babylonian names. Daniel was also given a Babylonian name that he is referred to that we're going to see tonight. What was his Babylonian name? Yeah, Belteshazzar. Very similar in name to the king that they're going to be taking a look at tonight, Belshazzar. But it was a name given to him that has to do with one of their gods. But in any case, what we're going to be looking at tonight in this class of God's glory and salvation through judgment and how that's manifested in the book of Daniel is we're really going to be focusing on chapters 4 and 5 tonight. For the most part. And what I found as I was preparing was that the book of Daniel really does show us that through the judgment upon the Jews, via the exile from their land to Babylon, that God is preserving a remnant, number one. We see that evidenced and manifested in these four individuals, Daniel and Hananiah, Azariah and Mishael, or Mishael and Azariah. And then also that the central theme, at least that I consider the central theme of this book, is a statement that we find repeated multiple times in chapters 4 and 5. And that is that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men. This book uses various incidents to make that point abundantly clear. God is in charge. He is the one true God, and He will not share His glory or His majesty with anybody else. And whenever anybody refuses to acknowledge that, then He is going to humble them. And so He deserves the glory, and He's the one that rules. Regardless of what man thinks about their power and their might and what they have done to achieve greatness, it is Yahweh who is ruling in the kingdom of men. There is a certain structure, literary structure, to the book of Daniel that's been noticed by scholars for years and years and years and years. Specifically with chapters 2 through 7. I'll just very briefly mention a couple of things about the structure, but we're going to hone in on one particular aspect. Does anybody know anything about the language, the original language used in the book of Daniel? What would most of the language be in the Old Testament? What did they write and speak in? Hebrew, okay? But Daniel is an exception for a large portion of the book. It is written in, say again, Dave? Well, it's not referred to as Chaldean, but it originated, at least it became the language of the Chaldeans. It was the language that the Jews would have spoken after they came back from exile and still spoke in Jesus' day, Aramaic. Okay, from chapter 2, verse 4, in the middle of that verse there, when the quote begins of what was said to the king, from that point all the way through chapter 7 is Aramaic. Chapter 1 is Hebrew, up through chapter 2, verse 4, and then it's Aramaic, and then it reverts back to Hebrew for chapters 8 through 12. We're not going to talk about why all that is tonight. That's beyond the scope of this particular class. But that's just interesting to note. You might want to do some personal study on that and some theories as to why that's the case. But there's also another aspect that we are going to look at tonight because it plays a large role into what the book is really about and the theme of the book. And that is its chiastic structure. This has been well documented for many years. Chapter 1 is just an introduction, and you'll recall that in a chiastic structure, you have a theme that is then repeated later on. The introduction kind of just stands out by itself. It really doesn't have a corresponding section to it. But in chapter 2, we have the dream of the coming kingdoms. Remember, this is the dream that Nebuchadnezzar has of the statue of four different parts that is four different kingdoms. Chapter 3, we have an incident of divine deliverance, and it's the fiery furnace incident with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And then in chapter 4, we get to the center of the book. This is what the book is pointing to. It's the central part of the book, chapters 4 and 5. Chapter 4 is the humbling of Nebuchadnezzar. Chapter 5 is the humbling of Belshazzar. And so those two correspond. And then corresponding to the divine deliverance, the fiery furnace incident in chapter 3, well, we have in chapter 6 another incident of divine deliverance, and that is of Daniel in the lion's den. And then in chapter 7, we have the correspondent to the dream of the coming kingdoms that's found in chapter 2. Well, this time it's the vision of the coming kingdoms. And it's done in highly symbolic language and, you know, all these various beasts and so forth, but it is about the coming kingdoms. And so you can see how each one of these corresponds with another, and you see the central part of this section of the book of Daniel has to do with the humbling of these two kings who refused to give the glory and honor to Yahweh. Now, this theme is still present even in chapters 8 through 12 as well, but this seems to be the main focus, at least of this first section, and that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. Questions or comments so far, or observations anybody has? Okay, so let's get into the text and take a look at some aspects of these chapters. We're not going to take a look at chapter 1 tonight. I do want to make a couple of comments about chapter 2, so go ahead and turn over to chapter 2. And this dream of the kingdoms of man, and then, of course, the kingdom of heaven, kingdom of God, that is established during the days of that fourth king. Or kingdom, rather. Okay, so in chapter 2, we're told that Nebuchadnezzar has this dream. He's troubled by it, but he doesn't even remember what the dream was, or at the very least, he wants all the wise men, the magicians, all those people in his kingdom to tell him what the dream was, as well as the interpretation. Well, what's the problem with that? Huh? Yeah, it's got to be magic in their eyes, you know, to be able to come up with the dream and the interpretation. Can anybody come up with an interpretation of a dream and make it sound believable? Yeah, I mean, you don't have to have any special powers to do that. As much as they would like to purport that's what it is, that they have these special powers, whether it be imbued upon them by their gods or whatever. You know, you can come up with what the dream means and make it believable. But for Nebuchadnezzar to say, hey, you've got to tell me what the dream was first, and then the interpretation, they say, we can't do that. And they beg of him to just, you tell us the dream and we'll tell you the interpretation. Nebuchadnezzar says, nope, too bad, so sad, you're all dying. And so he sends out the command, they're going about killing all the wise men, and they come to Daniel and to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah as well, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they're getting ready to kill them when Daniel says, wait a minute, no, just take me to your king, and Yahweh will help me interpret this. Take a look at some of the things that Daniel says. Let's begin in let's go to verse 20. Or verse 19, actually. Then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So God gives him the secret of the dream and the interpretation. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's demand. So he is ascribing to God the proper glory and honor that he deserves, because he recognizes it's not within him to be able to do this, but it is from God above. And look at verse 44. He is now brought before Nebuchadnezzar. He tells him the dream, and he tells him the interpretation of the dream. And he says in verse 44, and in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Let's backtrack really quickly. What are the four kingdoms known to us in hindsight of these world powers? And he tells him, he doesn't necessarily give him the names of these kingdoms, except for the first one. Who's the first one? Yeah, the current kingdom of Babylon that Nebuchadnezzar is king over. Okay, and then who was the next world power that came after the Babylonians? The Medo-Persians. And then after that was the Greeks. And then after that would be the Romans. Okay, those were the major world powers of that time. And so it was during that fourth kingdom, the Roman kingdom, that he says in this dream, or he gives the interpretation of this dream, that this stone was cut out, not by hand, but it was just cut out and came and crashed into the statue, destroyed it, and then that stone became gradually grew and grew and grew and became like a mountain and encompassed the whole earth. And he says that it was that this represented God's kingdom, which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom will not be left to other people and break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms. What does that say about Yahweh? The fact that this kingdom is going to consume all other kingdoms, can never be destroyed, what does that say about Yahweh? Okay, that he is in charge. Is he like any of the other gods that people believe that there may be? I mean, even if you were to grant that there were other gods, you know, and I'm not doing that, and Daniel's not doing that, but even if you were to grant that, this just shows that he is superior to all of that. Okay. So this dream is revealing really what is the incomparable greatness of God, because he's the only one that can sustain an everlasting kingdom. No man can do that, and And none of these other kingdoms are going to last. His is going to be the one that lasts. What else does this say about God and specifically about Nebuchadnezzar? Back up to verse 37. As Daniel begins to tell Nebuchadnezzar the interpretation, he says in verse 37, "You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold." He emphasizes the point that you're in this position because God put you there. Yahweh is the one that is in control. He's the one that's in charge. And to pull from chapter 4 and 5, the Most High is the one that's ruling in the kingdoms of men. The rest of that phrase goes on to say that he sets over it whom he chooses. He sets over it the lowliest of men. He decides who's going to rule and when. And Daniel says, the reason why you are a king, the reason why you have this kingdom, the reason why you have this power, is because God gave it to you. Okay. Now that's a lesson that Nebuchadnezzar has to learn over and over and over in the book of Daniel. Okay. Look at chapter 2 and verse 47. After giving the interpretation, King Nebuchadnezzar, verse 46, rather, to begin with, he says, "He fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. The king answered Daniel and said, 'Truly, your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret.'" Okay, so he acknowledges that there's something different about this God. And when he says he is the God of gods, that's a statement of he is superior to any other gods, right? He recognizes that. Does Nebuchadnezzar ever become a monotheist, as far as we know, in the book of Daniel? That means, does he only believe in one God, Yahweh? No. Now, he still is a pagan. He still believes in the other gods. But all these scenarios, all these incidents happen to cause him to see, okay, Yahweh is different. And this is all God's doing, of course. This is him doing this to Nebuchadnezzar on purpose. So this incident results in God being glorified, even in the pagans' eyes. That's what I want you to see. Okay. All right. Comments or questions on that? Tom, you look like you're itching to say something.
Well, I was just thinking that if he had gone ahead with what he's saying and believed that God was the God, then what happened to him wouldn't have happened.
Right. Yeah, and while he may recognize there's something special about Yahweh, it's obvious he doesn't recognize him as the only true God because of what happens in the next couple chapters. Yeah, right. God is going to be glorified, and he's going to make sure that he's glorified. And he will use even wicked pagans to accomplish that purpose. And he's going to make sure that they recognize who he is. I mean, it's just a constant refrain throughout Scripture, as we have seen in this class. Okay? So this also serves, but besides serving the purpose of magnifying himself for Nebuchadnezzar, or in Nebuchadnezzar's eyes, this also serves the purpose of doing what for Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? What happens as a result of this? They are promoted and given all kinds of honor and glory themselves and gifts and so forth, and that they're given these positions. So that is, in a sense, a type of salvation for them, is it not? In fact, what was going to happen if Daniel hadn't have spoken up? They would have been killed. And, you know, God saved them through this. Okay. All right. So let's go on to chapter 3, unless anybody else has something to say on chapter 2. All right, chapter 3, we have the fiery furnace with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And in spite of acknowledging Yahweh as the God of gods and the Lord of kings, that is the Master of kings and so forth, he still is a pagan and still wants to worship other gods. And we don't know what this image was that is built. We don't know if it was for some god, if it was of himself. It's just an image is all that's said. But he erects this image that everybody is to worship at the prescribed time and in the prescribed manner. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, of course, refused to do so. Now, we're not told about any other Jews, what they did. We're not told even about Daniel and what he did or did not do. You would have to imagine that Daniel would not have kneeled and bowed and worshiped this image as well. But the story focuses on these three individuals. And God saves his people and judges his adversaries. What happens when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are brought before Nebuchadnezzar because they did not bow down and worship? Did he take that too well? What was his reaction? Okay. He was mad. He was furious. And he gave them a second chance. And what did they do? Same thing. They refused to obey the king because they were not going to be guilty of idolatry. So this makes him even madder, and what does he do as a result? What does he say? Yeah, heat it up how many times beyond what the normal amount? Yeah, seven times hotter. Now, I don't know what kind of measuring stick, device they had to measure just how hot it was, but how do you get seven times hotter? I don't know. Make it a whole lot hotter than it ever was before. We're going to guarantee these people are going to fry. Is the point. And instead of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego being the ones who are burned up, who are?
The man who put them in the fire.
Yeah, they're captors. The ones that were going to be taking them and putting them in the fire. They're the ones that are burned up. So God is delivering his people and judging their adversaries, which is just another constant refrain through Scripture. And theme. So because of God's salvation, take a look at what Nebuchadnezzar says again. Go to the end of the chapter 3, and verse 28 and 29. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, "Blessed be the God," this is giving glory to God, to Yahweh. "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him. And they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap. Because there is no other God who can deliver like this." So Nebuchadnezzar is forced once again by these events to acknowledge, to recognize that Yahweh is supreme, that he is superior, and you don't mess with Yahweh. He's protected his people. Okay. Yes, Jennifer. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. while the story is focusing on these three individuals, obviously that would have been extrapolated out to the rest of the Jewish people that were in captivity. And so this goes back to my one of my introductory points, that God is, in these stories of these four individuals, is showing how he is preserving a remnant of his faithful people. And they will be restored back to their land eventually. But while they're in captivity, God's protecting them. He is taking care of them. Okay? Good point. Anything else on chapter 3? Okay, so let's go to chapter 4 and 5, and this is where I want to spend the bulk of our time tonight. Nebuchadnezzar has a second dream. Can somebody summarize for me what this second dream was about? What did he see? What's the main figure?
A huge tree.
Yeah, a huge tree. Just how big is this tree in the dream? Okay, went all the way up in the sky, touching the heavens. And what else does it say about how big this tree was? It says you could see it from all the lands. I mean, no matter where you went, you could see this tree. That's how big this tree was. Okay, and you got all these animals in the tree and so forth, but what happens to the tree? What else does he see? Okay, why was it cut down, and who did the cutting down? Or at least who issued that? Yeah. You've got this holy one, this watcher from heaven, and this command from God to cut down this tree. But what's significant about the cutting down of the tree? Is it done for? Yeah, left the stump. Okay, so it's not completely gone, but its magnificence has been done away with, right? Take a look at the interpretation. Actually, take a look at the dream itself. One statement there found in verse 17, and this is the first instance of this phrase. It says, "This decision is by the decree of the watchers, and the sentence by the word of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets over it the lowest of men." By the way, when you notice the change in terminology from verse 15, or before verse 15, you see it's talking about the tree. But what changes in verse 15 in the wording that's used? Changes from talking about a tree to talking about what? A man. You see that in verse 15? "Nevertheless, leave the stump and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze, and the tender grass of the field. Let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let him graze with the beast on the grass of the earth. Let his heart be changed from that of a man. Let him be given the heart of a beast, and let seven times pass over him." Okay, so obviously this tree is representing some man, and the interpretation is going to tell us that it's Nebuchadnezzar. This seven times, verse 16 talks about seven times passing over him. Does anybody have a footnote or a different word that your Bible uses there for the word times?
I have a footnote
that says 7 years. Okay. Season. Yours says, okay, so Becky says years, yours says seasons. The literal word is times. The debate is, well, how long are these times? And what does it mean, seven times? Seven times of what? Of seasons, of years, months? We don't know. The most common thought is years, that it may have been 7 years that is being referenced here. But we don't know that for sure. It's just seven times. However long of a period that was. It may have been months. It may have been an indefinite period of time that God had predetermined. How, you know, this is going to be this amount of time. And you know, seven also indicates what in the Bible?
Blessing.
completion, you know, perfection and so forth. So that's probably a reason for the number seven there. Oh, is that what you want to say, Barry? Sorry to steal your thunder there. However long this was, you get the idea, though, that it was not just a few days. Why? I mean, it couldn't have been a few days. Long enough for him to grow a beard, and what else did you say? And the birds would nest in? And what else about his appearance is stated as well? The fingernails growing really long, like birds' claws, and what did you say? Yeah, his hair growing long like eagle's feathers. I'm curious, who in here, guys, in your younger days had really long hair? I knew BJ was going to raise his hand. I've seen a picture before. Steve, you had long hair. So just how long was your hair, if you don't mind sharing? Shoulders? 8 inches down your back. I want to see a picture of that, Steve. Okay, everybody look at Steve and try to imagine him with hair 8 inches down his back. Yeah. It took a while, didn't it? Starting out with short hair. And ladies, of course, those of you with long hair, I don't know if you remember back to when, maybe you've always had long hair, so you can't put a timetable on it, but for most guys, you know, they start out with short hair and then they decide one day they're going to let it grow long. Some people, of course, it's not going to happen. But, it takes a long time. 7 years would probably be more along the time frame that this would have happened. It may have been longer, may have been shorter, but we need to imagine more than just days, more than weeks, and more than months. This would have been over a period of years, most likely. So this is the dream. He hasn't given the interpretation yet, but you already see it's talking about some man. And you see the point of what's happening is given in verse 17, where it says that this is going to happen so that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sits over at the lowest of men. And so now, look at verse 18. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. So we're quoting from Nebuchadnezzar now. Now you, Belteshazzar, that's Daniel, declare its interpretation. He recognizes, he says in verse 18, that the Spirit of the Holy God is in you. You can do this. You've already done it for me once before. You can do it again. So let's go to the interpretation in verse 19 and following. It troubles Daniel. He doesn't like the interpretation, but he says in verse 22, the tree is you, O king, who have grown and become strong, for your greatness has grown and reaches to the heavens and your dominion to the end of the earth. And then verse 23 mentions about what's going to happen to the tree again and grazing with the beast of the field till 7 times pass over him. He says the interpretation is, in verse 25, they shall drive you from men, your dwelling shall be with the beast of the field, and they shall make you eat grass like oxen. They shall wet you with the dew of heaven, and 7 times shall pass over you till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. And inasmuch as they gave the command to leave the stump and roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be assured to you after you come to know that heaven rules. Now there's another part of that phrase there, just an abbreviated form of that phrase, stated again in verse 26. And his plea, verse 27, to the king is, break off your sins by being righteous and your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. Perhaps there may be a lengthening of your prosperity. So Daniel says, this is what's going to happen to you. You have an opportunity to stop it, though. Please do that. But the next verse, or the next two verses, it says that a year later, 12 months later, verse 30, the king spoke saying, is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty? Wrong thing to say. Why is that the wrong thing to say?
It was taken for granted that
We don't even like that as humans, do we? When somebody else takes the credit for somebody else's work. And we recognize the injustice in that, and that people that do the work should get the credit. But when we're talking about on such a magnitude as this, about the kingdom that is over the whole earth at this present time, or that part of the world, and God, and taking away the credit that belongs to God, He is going to make sure that that person gets the judgment that they deserve, and that he gets the glory that he deserves. And so it says that while the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven, King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you. Verse 32 repeats that phrase, this is going to happen to you until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. This is a purposeful humbling of the greatest king of that time by Yahweh to show him and to show all people that Yahweh is the one that deserves the glory, not man. And Nebuchadnezzar finally realizes this. Look at what he says in verse 34 and following. At the end of the time, whenever that time was up, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven and my understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever, for his dominion is an everlasting dominion and his kingdom is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and splendor returned to me. My counselors and nobles restored to me. I was restored to my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth and his ways justice. And those who walk in pride, he is able to put down. Circle, underline, star that statement right there. He learned it the hard way. And of course, the point that we have been making in this class over and over again is we need to make sure we learn that lesson and willingly give God the glory rather than wait for ourselves to be humbled. Okay. Barry. And dare we think we're any different than Nebuchadnezzar? Now, none of us have a kingdom that we're ruling over. But we can all be guilty of that kind of an attitude, right? In our own little kingdoms? Anybody here proud of the accomplishments that they have had over the years? There's nothing wrong with being proud of what you've done and glad that you have succeeded in whatever it is. Okay. What's our temptation? Is to say the same thing, just in a different way. Look at what I have done. And look at what I have accomplished and how everybody is looking at me and giving me honor and glory because of whatever that is. Whether it be your job, whether it be your house, whether it be the car you drive. Are cars a statement maker? Do people buy cars to make statements? Yeah, some do, right. But, I mean, it is a known fact that people do that, right? And they want to know what people think of. I mean, they want people to see their car and think a certain way about them, and same thing with their house. I mean, that's their glory and honor they're concerned about. Right? We can be just as guilty on a smaller scale. Mm-hmm. We can be guilty of being overconfident in our abilities and what we have done, whether it be physical or spiritual, and make the same mistake that Nebuchadnezzar made. And so that's the one of the two stories that are the central part of these first seven chapters. Let's take a look at Belshazzar now in the next chapter. By the way, I meant to say this a while ago about this chiastic structure. The first seven chapters are not in chronological order. Now, chapter 5 does follow chapter 4 chronologically. But it's not in chronological order. It's arranged purposely to focus in on these two chapters. And so things are out of order as far as time are concerned. But chapter 6, you have Belshazzar, who was the son of Nabonidus, who was the recognized king, but he was the, records have since shown that he was the co-regent. His father was out of town quite a bit and left his son in charge while he was off doing his own thing elsewhere in the kingdom. And it talks about Nebuchadnezzar being his father, but we need to understand that in the sense of ancestor, because we know that there were three or four other kings between between Belshazzar and Nebuchadnezzar. Short amount of time, because they didn't last very long, but Nebuchadnezzar was not his immediate father. But Belshazzar is hosting this feast, and what is he using to serve all the food and drink? Utensils from the temple in Jerusalem that Nebuchadnezzar had destroyed in 586 BC and brought everything back. Why would he do that? Why would he use those utensils? I mean, certainly he had other utensils. To show his dominance over that people and their God. Okay, this was a slap in the face to Yahweh, is what this amounts to. This was saying, our gods and our kingdom is better than your God and your king. And by using those utensils in an idolatrous way as well, then that's going to be a slight to Yahweh is what this is. This is where, of course, he receives, they see this vision of the hand writing on the wall. It's where we get the phrase that somebody has seen the handwriting on the wall. And he's obviously extremely troubled by that. They tell him to call forth Daniel. And so in verse 13, we see Daniel is brought before the king. In verse 17, Daniel begins speaking to the king. He's been offered gifts and so forth. And Daniel says, you can keep your gifts for yourself, but I will give you the interpretation. Verse 18, O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, again, just think of that as ancestor, a kingdom and majesty, glory and honor. And because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Verse 20, but when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne and they took his glory from him. Then he was driven from the sons of men. Look at the end of verse 21, it says, till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomever he chooses. There's that phrase. But you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this. So you don't have an excuse, Belshazzar. You know the story. Either you witnessed it firsthand, you were told about it, whatever. You know the story. You don't have an excuse for this. He was forced to humble himself, and he finally recognized that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men. But you, verse 23, you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. And he talks about using those utensils and so forth. Verse 23 says, you have praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze and iron, wood and stone, which do not see or hear or know. And the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified. And so he is humbled. That in the interpretation of the writing on the wall is that God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. You have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. And that very night he was slain. You have the Persians coming in and surprising the Babylonians. Interesting historical read if you want to read some more about that. But Belshazzar makes the same mistake in a different way. He glorifies other gods, he glorifies himself, and basically disses Yahweh and is judged and humbled as a result of that. Chapter 6, Lion's Den, story that you're probably familiar with, just another incident of divine deliverance. And very quickly, before the final bell, when Darius releases him from the lion's den, take a look at what he says in chapter 6 and verse 25, please. We'll close with this. Chapter 6 and verse 25. Same thing that Yahweh did. Nebuchadnezzar did. Then King Darius wrote, "To all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions." God will be glorified even if people refuse to do it. On their own, he is going to make sure that they recognize him. Same lesson for us as always is that we should serve our life glorifying him. Don't wait until we're forced to do something.